Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be talking to you today about the Troubadour series at the Guthrie Center this Saturday, August 18th at 8 p.m. This year is a tribute to songwriter Doc Pomus, with Marshall Crenshaw, Willie Nile, and Christine Ullman performing. Joining us today to talk about the event, and about himself, I hope, is American musician, singer, songwriter, actor, producer, and one of the aforementioned headliners, Marshall Crenshaw. Marshall Crenshaw is perhaps best known for his song Some Days, Some Way, a top U.S. 40 hit in 1982. His music has roots in classical soul music and Buddy Holly, the latter to whom Crenshaw was often compared in the early days of his career, and whom he portrayed in the 1987 film La Bamba. Crenshaw is also a noted guitarist. Along the way, Crenshaw's compositions have been covered by a broad array of performers, including Bette Midler, Kelly Willis, Robert Gordon, Ronnie Spector, Marty Jones, and the Gin Blossoms, with whom Crenshaw co-wrote the top 10 single, Till I Hear It From You. He's also provided music for several film soundtracks, appeared in the films La Bamba and Peggy Sue Got Married, and was nominated for Grammy and Golden Globe Awards for writing the title track for the film comedy Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. Since 2011, Crenshaw has hosted his own radio show, The Bottomless Pit, on New York's WFUV. He also worked on Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger's HBO series Vinyl, doing some session work and a little bit of songwriting. We'll talk to Marshall Crenshaw about all of this and much more. But first, let me take a moment to welcome you, Marshall Crenshaw.
Hey, Alan.
So, Marshall Crenshaw, let's start about the Guthrie Center, to whom I am totally devoted, and quite frequently, if they don't live within an hour, we put up their guests at the Chartok House. But anyway, how did this gig come about?
Well, going back to the early 1980s, somewhere during that time frame, I met Doc Pomus, legendary songwriter and legendary human being, Doc Pomus. And Doc was sort of like a godfather or like an idol to a lot of us young songwriters on the New York scene. And he was always out and about. Doc was confined to a wheelchair, but he would get around town and come to people's gigs, and he was really supportive of young songwriters. And he and I got to be friends. I'd go over and visit him and sit in his apartment and listen to him yell at people on the telephone and just have all kinds of interesting conversations with this guy who'd had this real epic life and was one of my heroes. And then he passed away, and his daughter asked me if I wanted this musical instrument that was sitting in Doc's bedroom. And it was this old chord organ with push buttons, kind of a funny instrument, like sort of like an accordion in a wooden case. But anyway, she gave me this instrument, and I had it as a sort of a keepsake for 20-plus years, 30 years. And now it's that point in life when my wife and I are starting to downsize, and we want to move into a smaller house, and et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, okay, what can I do with this? And my wife is a lifelong Arlo Guthrie fan, and she saw on their website that they accept donations of musical instruments. So I reached out to them. I said, I have this instrument. It's like of historical significance. And they said, sure, we'll take it. And then the next thing I knew, they wanted to know if I would do a tribute show to Doc Pomus at the Guthrie Center. So that's kind of a short version of the story, but I asked Willie Nile, because I knew that he was close to Doc the way that I was, and then Christine is just somebody that we knew that she knew the catalog and that she's a great performer and stuff. So it's going to be like an in-the-round kind of thing with the three of us.
So it's astounding, isn't it, that Pomus, who was so prolific and who was so good at his jobs and writing all of these songs, and for example, he wrote Save the Last Dance for Me.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye, let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me.
It's a great, great song. But he himself wasn't all that well known.
No, he wasn't. He was just, one of the names on the record labels. And he had a partner, too, a guy named Mort Schumann. Mort Schumann actually became a big star in France after he and Doc stopped working together. Mort moved over to France and had a bunch of hits there in French.
Allô, papa, tango, Charlie, bien. Ici Papa Tango Charlie, auriez-vous compris enfin? J'ai perdu celle que j'aimais, ne la retrouverai jamais. Je vais noyer ma solitude dans le triangle des Bermudes.
He collaborated with Jacques Brel, you know, he had a pretty high profile, but Doc always kind of stayed in the background. But people that knew Doc, it was like he was a really remarkable person. So if you knew him, you know, it was like a thing that you never got over, you know. He's a brilliant guy. He was from a family of scholars and lawyers. Doc's younger brother is Raoul Felder, the famous divorce lawyer. But Doc was like the bohemian in the family, you know, he's like the outlaw in the family, and he fell in love with the blues during his teens, and that set the course of his whole life. He idolized Big Joe Turner, so he just went down that road. His family might have been kind of shocked by the whole thing, but anyway, Doc just had lived and, you know, just seen a lot of life from a vantage point that was uniquely his own, and just to hang around with him was really the gas. Now it's like a dream or something that I ever knew him, you know. He's just really a cool person. I'd go to his birthday parties, and it would be like Lieber and Stoller would be there, Phil Spector would be there, you know, like Lyle Lovett, and it was cool to hang around with him.
So why was he in the wheelchair?
Well, he had polio as a child, you know. He grew up, I guess, before there was a Salk vaccine, and a lot of kids got it back then. When you see pictures of him as a kid, he's on crutches. And I'm not sure when it finally turned into a thing with him in a wheelchair all the time or in bed all the time. He got around on crutches pretty good, I guess, for a lot of years. But that's all. He was just like a childhood polio victim.
So how old would he have been now?
Old. I mean, he's probably a little older than my dad was. I don't know the exact date, although I should. But I'm going to say Doc was born like 1929 or something like that.
Wow. Okay, we'll come back to Doc. I want to talk to you about you. Tell me where you were born.
I was born in Detroit in 1953.
So you're a kid. You're talking to a guy born in 1942, so you were born in 1953. Yeah. I see you as a kid.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, great. Great. Thank you for that. Yeah. Okay, so Marshall, first of all, what did your parents do?
Well, let me see. My dad, for a lot of years, he worked for the town that we lived in, which was Berkeley, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. My mother was a high school English teacher. As far as my interest in music goes, it started really early on before I could even, like, explain why, you know, it was just as a child. Growing up, I was really obsessed and more interested in what was on the radio than I was in the world around me almost, you know. It was crazy, but anyhow, you know, I just started really young. I experienced early rock and roll firsthand as a child, you know. I saw Buddy Holly on the Ed Sullivan Show, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way it was. I was just, like, really drawn to it and got on the road as soon as I could, which was my early 20s. And I wound up in New York. It was an accident, almost. First, I headed west to L.A., and then on that same trip, I kind of wound up on the opposite side of the country. I got hired as an understudy in Beatlemania on Broadway. And so I never did the show on Broadway, but I was an understudy for 6 months. And then that was the thing where I wound up in a touring company and in the West Coast company. After that, I wanted to make records of my own. And so that's the story with that.
So were there siblings in your family?
Yeah, my brother Robert played drums with me for a while. And then I have two other brothers. I have a brother who lives in Texas, and then I have another brother who lives down in Westchester. Four sons in the family. I'm the eldest.
And what was your instrument, Marshall?
I'm a guitar player.
Yeah.
So you picked up a guitar.
Yeah, my dad had a guitar, you know, and my dad was like a high-spirited kind of guy. He used to play the guitar even though he only knew maybe two chords. But, yeah, I feel like I got that rubbed off on me, his interest in music. And it was his musical taste that I glommed onto in the beginning because he really liked rock and roll and R&B, which was a little freaky for somebody of his generation and the environment we were in. But anyway, I've just done it all my life, you know, and that's it.
When you played Buddy Holly in the movies, did you feel any, I don't know how to say it, but for those of us who are real Buddy Holly fans, did you feel a connection to the guy?
Yeah, I'm a lifelong fan of his. And over the years, it's become possible to kind of know something about what he was like as a person.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Thank you. We're going to do some obscure, lesser-known Buddy Holly songs for you. This is Buddy Holly's first record. It's called Blue Days, Black Nights. Blue days, black nights, my heart keeps on calling for you, dear, and you alone. Memories of you make me sorry. I gave you reason to doubt me, but now you're gone, and I am left here all alone with blue memories. I think of you. Think about that.
You know, back in the 50s, like, all the pop stars of the time were kind of opaque, I guess, you know. Like, you know, you read interviews from back then, and there's just, like, nothing of substance being discussed at all, ever, you know. But anyhow, I feel like this might sound a little oddball, but there was some of those guys from back in the 50s, like Buddy Holly and Alan Freed and Sam Phillips and Elvis Presley and certain ones, you know, that it seems like they were conscious about the racial taboos that they were challenging. It's like they wanted to do that, you know, and I would put Buddy Holly in that group. So, I mean, the more I know about him, I just think, I mean, he was only like a baby when he died, you know, but I think this is a pretty interesting person, you know, who got pretty far in the world. I mean, I've been to Lubbock, Texas. I've been to that part of the country. He really went a long way, you know, so he must have had a pretty broad imagination, pretty strong life force to get out there like that. So I'm still a fan of his, really. You know, I still love the music. I still think of him in a positive light, you know.
How old was he when he died in that crash?
22.
Wow.
You know, I know. I think about, you know, him out on that horrible tour and, you know, like chartering a plane and just taking care of himself and all these unfamiliar situations. And that's pretty good. You know, I couldn't really do that when I was 22 myself. Well, I don't know. Maybe I could if I had to, but you know, he's impressive, you know, Buddy Holly.
So, Marshall Crenshaw, who is your contemporary musical hero?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I finally started to make my own records and such and, like, develop my own music and my own style and all that, you know, I was just really interested in the contemporary scene in general. Always had, like, a broad range of stuff that I was checking out. And that's from growing up with 50s Top 40, which was mostly rock and roll, but it was also diverse and eclectic. And the beginning days of FM rock radio was just like anything goes kind of thing, you know. And the other thing is now everything is in its own little slot, and you can go through life and only listen to stuff that you already know that you like. It's real easy to do that now. But with 50s and 60s Top 40, it was just like a little bit of everything thrown into the pot. And I still like it that way. Early 80s, when I was making records, it was like there was new wave rock that was a thing right at that moment. And I liked all that stuff, you know, like the Ramones and the Clash and on and on and on from that time period. And I also would listen to the urban stations. I just liked what I was hearing over there, too. Just enthusiastic in general about popular music. I mean, there's, of course, a lot of stuff I would say that I hated, but I'm not going to name any of that.
Yeah. Were you an Elvis fan?
Yeah. Two of my cousins were like older sisters to me, my cousin Carol, my cousin Marilyn, and they were, you know, teenage Elvis fans, and they had his records and were hung up on Elvis. There was this documentary about him on HBO a little while ago that I thought was a little twisted, where they're trying to rehabilitate him or something, which I don't think is necessary.
Mm.
But I still like, you know, I like all that stuff. I still feel connected to 50s rock and roll.
Fascinating character, you know. My wife has just finished a book on Elvis Presley's relationship with Jewish people. And he did very well. He studied Kabbalah, you know, he knew all of that stuff. And in the, and in
really?
The, yeah. And in the Memphis Mafia, half of them were Jewish, something like that. And it really was fascinating. And he also, as you point out quite correctly, was very close to black music and to black performers. And that made him an extraordinary character. The more we learn about him, you know, this was no dope, that's for sure. His only downside was the Colonel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I got to get that book. That sounds good.
Yeah, we got to make sure you get it. Okay, so anyway, I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about the radio program you have on WFUV. Now, that makes us colleagues. And we're members of WFUV, by the way, Roselle and I. So tell me about what that's been like.
Well, in fact, the show is on hiatus right now, temporarily, I think. I think I will go back to doing it at some point in time. But the show was called The Bottomless Pit. I started doing it on WKZE, which is here in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
And then switched over to FUV back in 2011. It was just an hour-long thing. It was short, you know, and I kind of liked it that way. My wife would refer to it as my weekly therapy session. And
I get it.
Yeah, I would just pull stuff from my record collection, and sometimes I would talk about what I was playing and talk a lot or too much. And then other times I would just put my iPod on shuffle and play that and then talk about what I played.
Sounds like I like listening to you. Now, you mentioned that your wife is an Arlo fan. What accounts for that?
Well, it started out, you know, in her teen years, so I think she just had a crush on him at first, and maybe still does. But, yeah, you know, the Alice's Restaurant was like a phenomenon, kind of, you know. He was a pop star during those times, and a cool one, too. You know, I mean, I liked him myself and still do. But she had a poster of him on her bedroom wall. And the whole. She's going to get mad at me for spilling all this. But anyway, yeah, she just dug him and liked his music and his records. You know, how people are fans of this one or that one. And with her, Arlo Guthrie was one of the ones. And, you know, like a lot of people, she just holds on to that stuff from her youth and so forth. You know, I do the same thing. So she's always checking out the website for the Guthrie Center. And then when we went to the place to donate the organ, it was really exciting for
her. That's Doc Pumice's organ, yeah. Right.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was really exciting for her to make the pilgrimage to that place, even though it's not that far from where we live, but we never had a reason to go there until then. But I thought it was a gas, too, you know, because I love the movie Alice's Restaurant, and that's the place where they shot the thing, you know, and it was cool to be inside that building.
I know it. You know, we live in walking distance of the church, my wife and I in Great Barrington, and we love that place. I mean, it's just an extraordinary achievement that both Arlo, who paid for it, and George Lay, the manager who has put it all together and keeps doing this magnificent work, has done. And it, you know, it's so interesting. You go there, and there are cars stopped in front of it, and some tourists will get out, and George will come out and take them for a walk through the place. And it started with leaks in the ceiling, and now it's air conditioned. It's got a new roof. It's got your organ in it. It's a beautiful place. It really is. It's extraordinary. And people show up there to perform who would not play that size venue, you know, other than the fact that they are paying reverence to the place and to Woody, of course, because Arlo is Woody's kid. Did you do any folk music as a kid?
I was a rock and roller always. Right. And so whatever I knew of folk music, quote unquote, was whatever crossed over to pop radio, you know. So that would be a pretty mixed bag, right? You know, like Blowing in the Wind, of course, by Peter, Paul, and Mary. That was a big hit, and that's a real important song.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? Must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blow.
same time, it's like the Serendipity Singers and all that stuff that they satirized in the movie A Mighty Wind.
Don't let the rain come down. Oh yes, my roof's got a hole in it and I might drown.
I hated that film, Marshall, and I'm the only one who hated it. Everybody else loved it. Because I thought they made fun of Pete Seeger, who is my all-time hero, and Harold Levinthal, who is his manager. And when I asked Levinthal before he died about that, I said, he said, no, they told me it wasn't about me. So that's really great. The fact that that center is there, it has become quite a destination for people from all over the world. And now you're going to be playing it. What are your expectations?
Well, I'm, you know, optimistic about the quality of the show. I know that the music is great. I know that the three of us are really looking forward to it. And I know that both Willie and Christine are great. You know, for me, for sure, it's about paying tribute to Doc Pomus, just somebody that I'm really thankful that I ever knew. And that's it. You know, the songs really have a depth to them. They're pop songs, but his best songs, even the, you know, like the sort of poppy ones, there's something real about his music. He was what they call a Brill Building kind of guy. There's a building across the street from the Brill Building, which is 1620 Broadway. And that's where, you know, Doc showed up at the office every day. And he would grind it out sometimes, him and his partner. But the best known ones, the ones that rise to the top, there's something just beautifully poetic about the songs. And those are the ones that we're going to try to focus on that night. His first hits were for Fabian. Do you remember Fabian?
Sure.
A strolling in the springtime. A strolling with my honey.
He started out kind of writing that sort of fluff stuff for him. But, I mean, those songs are good, too. There's one called Tiger.
Hey, lump of sugar, you look kind of sweet. Cuter than a baby walking down the street. When I look into your eyes, I want to leap. I can't conceal that you make me feel like a tiger. Ooh, like a tiger. Ooh, just to see you smile really drives me wild. I want to growl. Wow.
But, I mean, you know, Save the Last Dance for me really has a sort of a depth to it. And the ones for Elvis Presley, those are really cool, too. You know, there's, like, substance to them.
I just got your letter, baby. Too bad you can't come home. I swear I'm going crazy. Sitting here all alone. Since you're gone.
Talking with American musician, singer, songwriter, and producer Marshall Crenshaw about the tribute concert to songwriter Doc Pomus this Saturday, August 18th. Doors open at 6, concert at 8 p.m. at the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. You can find out more at guthriecenter.org. And let me just tell you, they have a great chef there, Marshall. And you can have a really good sort of very respectable, you know, semi-vegetarian meal there. Really, really good. Really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, and they feed you, you know. So let me ask you about your fellow participants in the Willie Nile and Christine Ullman. Tell us a little bit about them and what and their relationship to Doc.
Well, let me see. Willie Nile is from Buffalo originally, but he's been in New York City for I don't know how long, and You know, he's a recording artist, a songwriter, and just a really great rock and roller. Whenever I see him play, I'm always just, like, really blown away.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they are forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
You know, he's just really passionate about the whole thing, and he rocks, you know, and he's a great writer, too, you know, like his own songs are really worthy. And he's a really nice person. I've known him a long time. He started out at this place that I never played at this place, but a few of my friends came up through this joint in New York called Kenny's Castaways. And Doc frequented that place. It was a place where he liked to hang out for some reason. So, you know, Doc was just like an early booster of Willie's. Willie eventually got signed at Arista Records and made some albums for them. So Willie's kind of, you know, he's in the same shoes that I'm in, you know. He's just somebody that got to know Doc, and, you know, the two of them appreciated one another. And so all you got to do to somebody who knew Doc is just say his name, and pretty soon they'll start gushing about him, you know. So I knew that Willie had that connection with him. That's why I asked him to help me out with this show. And then Christine, you know, she's got her own story. I don't think she ever knew Doc Pomus, but she probably knows more of his catalog than I do. You know, I would imagine she's got a real encyclopedic knowledge of music from the 60s especially, and so forth. And she's a great singer, you know. She's somebody who really takes command when she performs, and is very kind of magnetic as a performer. Classy, and she's cool, and so I just figured it'd be a good threesome with us. That's the plan. And then you know, it's gonna be in the round, not exactly acoustic, but mostly acoustic, like an intimate evening with the three of us, so to speak. That's the plan right there.
So let me go back to your career if I can. But first, I want to remind everybody we're talking with American musician, singer, songwriter, and producer Marshall Crenshaw about the tribute concert to songwriter Doc Pomus this Saturday, August 18th. Doors open at 6, concert at 8 p.m. at the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. You can go to GuthrieCenter.org to find more about it. So I want to go back to more about you, Marshall. You're quite a well-known person to so many of us. Talk to us a little bit about the making of the film La Bamba. How was that? You know, was it your original film operation, or had you done this kind of thing before?
Well, yeah. Earlier, the same year that I did La Bamba, earlier that year, we appeared in a movie, Peggy Sue Got Married.
Right.
Which was pretty well-known movie from that time period.
Great movie.
Yeah, and that was my first time on a movie set, which was a real trip, you know, this kind of beehive of activity, a movie set. So let me see. There was Francis Coppola and Kathleen Turner.
Wow.
One of Nicolas Cage's first movies, and, you know, I knew that he was Francis's nephew. He does this cartoonish performance in the movie, right? And I watched him film those scenes, and I thought, he's ruining the movie. Somebody should stop him. That was my impression in the moment. But then now his performance is like my favorite thing in the whole movie. But anyway, so we did that. And then less than a year later, I was in La Bamba.
I want to go stay with Peggy Sue for a minute. My producer reminded me a while ago that everybody thought he was a clown in that, but turned out not to be.
Yeah, the thing was, I watched it and I thought, well, no, this isn't working. This is not right. But now I have the completely opposite view of it, you know, like I really get a kick out of the whole thing. But anyhow, it was great. You know, working on that thing was, you know, just like a real memorable experience.
Did they treat you well? I mean, there you are. You are now becoming a star and you're in the movie. Is it different from the rest of life, as they say? In other words, are you treated extraordinarily well? Do they do things for you? Do you have a trailer? What's it like?
Yeah, it was nice for sure. I mean, not all film shoots are like this, of course, but this was a full-on, big-budget Hollywood movie, you know. So, you know, like the food was really good. I remember, this is weird, the first time I ever had biscuits and gravy, which is like a Southern thing, was on the set of Peggy Sue Got Married. And I've loved it ever since. But when I'm in the South, I go to the Greasy Spoon Diner and get some biscuits and gravy. But the first time I ever had it was on the set of this, you know, Hollywood movie. Kind of weird. Yeah, it was all good. It was, you know, it was classy. Now, when I did La Bamba, that was a lower budget film. Not quite as slick as Peggy Sue Got Married, but still nice.
And how did they pick you to be Buddy Holly in La Bamba?
Let me see. Well, when the first press that I got came out, right away there was people saying, oh, it's Buddy Holly. He's got the glasses and the Stratocaster.
Crying.
And the bus broke down, the whole bus is shot. You didn't tell me this tour was gonna be like this.
The hell with it, man. Come home.
Oh, you mean quit?
No. If you're sick, man, you're sick. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
No, I'll stick it out. You just see what you can do about the bus, okay?
Okay. Look, take care of yourself, and I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay. Bye.
You know, I just happened to look the way that I look, and I wear glasses, and I play a Stratocaster. But there was truth in it, too, because, like I said, I always loved him. Yeah, I took a lot of inspiration from him always, and I suppose I still do. So it was cool. I mean, I was a little rankled by it in the beginning just because I didn't want to be compared to anybody. But anyhow, that's what triggered the casting director to think of me. They did the same thing with other parts in the movie. Like, they had Brian Setzer as Eddie Cochran.
Let's rock it now.
Son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
And he'd been compared to Eddie Cochran, kind of modeled himself on Eddie Cochran. So it made sense, you know, Brian Setzer is Eddie Cochran, me is Buddy Holly, and then the guys from Los Lobos. Covered a Ritchie Valens tune on one of their records, you know, so that was an obvious thing for them to cover the Ritchie Valens music. Mm. And then there was a guy named Howard Huntsbury who was Jackie Wilson.
Hey, hey, hey.
And he had a hit record at some point with a version of Doggin' Around by Jackie Wilson. So what they did was they just grabbed people from the contemporary scene that bore some resemblance to these 50s rock stars and put us in the movie. It was smart, actually, to do it, you know, from a marketing standpoint.
You had a reputation as a musician, Marshall Crenshaw, but now you're starring in major movies. What difference did that make in your life?
You know, like over the long run, I think it's really helped. You know, I've had, longevity, you would say, and it must have something to do with the fact that I was in those movies, I think, for sure. But the movies are still kind of out there in circulation, you know, so that's good for me.
So what's it like to be a star? I mean, you're walking around now. People say, hey, whoa, aren't you, and do they still come up to you and say, weren't you or aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes. And then at my shows, of course, that I do, you know, I don't know what to tell you, but it's just my profession and my vocation and that stuff. I'm in show business, so. Sometimes I joke and say everybody should be in at least one movie, and I was in two, so.
Two popular ones.
Twice as many, yeah.
So how'd you meet your wife?
High school.
Really? Isn't
that
interesting? And did you know as soon as you laid eyes on her that she was the one?
I'm not sure. That's a good question, you know, because I do remember seeing her for the first time, and it was when I was playing in a rock band. I was playing at an audition to play a dance at our high school. And I remember her sitting there and looking at me while I was playing. And we were playing a song by the MC5 called Tonight.
All right, everybody. Let's get together and have a policy. Sitting in the classroom, feel your heart going boom. Start to get the feeling and your head begin to reeling. You can't hear what the teacher's saying. You're going down about the rock road dance of town. You know, I just gotta hear that man play. Tonight, tonight, tonight. Whoa, tonight.
So I still remember that. I don't know. Been together forever.
Did you go to college?
No, I never did. I was.
Do you miss it, having not gone? I mean, you know, I'm a big believer that not everybody should go to college who has a gift. But do you ever think, boy, I know I should have done that?
Yeah, I have had that thought lots of times. But at that time in my life, there was just absolutely no way. You know, I couldn't stand any kind of regimentation. And I was really anxious to get out of school and never look back. I don't know. There's just no other way that it could have gone back in those days. You know, we've raised two kids ourselves, and I always tried to keep it a secret from them when they were growing up that I was such a slack student in high school. I would go to school, but then I wouldn't go in school, you know. I never wanted my own kids to know about any of that.
Well, and so what happened? Have they been more studious than you?
Yeah, they have. They just kind of dealt with it in their own way. I was afraid that they would think that they should emulate me if they knew what I had done, because that's how kids are sometimes.
Well, they got to know what you did, because some kid's going to walk up to them and say something to them, right? I mean, they have to know you were famous.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't. I meant if they knew how I approached school, that they would do it the same way themselves. That's all I'm talking about.
Sure. Well, how do kids do with a famous parent like yourself?
We just have what we all think of as a real normal life. So I don't know how to tell you about that. I mean, you'd have to ask them, I guess, but.
How old are they now?
19 and 21.
Are they going to go to college?
Our daughter's a senior at Buffalo State right now. Yeah, she's doing great. And our son, you know, he's not in college right now, but he says he's going to go back at some point.
Well, that's great. So I wanted to ask you about the musical gene. It's a question I often think of. You had music in you, that's obvious. Your father played the guitar, but, you know, no big. Are people born with a gene that basically either allows them to become an accountant or a musician?
I guess it's possible. I mean, it seems like it's certainly possible. I mean, I just, myself, that was it from the start, you know. And I don't know why or how I can do what I do, and why I can't do other things that I want to be able to do. Even musically, I mean, you know, like what I can just grab onto by ear, there are limitations to that. You know, they used to say I was musically inclined. That's the term, you know, so that was apparent to people around me from the time I was a little kid.
We're talking to the very talented Marshall Crenshaw, who is an American musician, singer, songwriter, and producer, about the tribute concert to songwriter Doc Pomus this Saturday, August 18th. The doors open at 6, concert at 8 p.m. at the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. If you've never been there, you are missing something big. You can find out more at GuthrieCenter.org. So let me ask you something. Are you a religious person?
Let me see. No, not. But why do you ask? No, I was raised.
Just flew into my head to ask you that.
I was raised Catholic, but I mean, my parents weren't that hardcore about it, so I drifted off from that at some point. Same with my wife. She's a Catholic school raised kid, but anyway, no, not really.
Was the high school you went to a Catholic school?
No, it wasn't. Yeah, okay. I mean, I wonder about like spiritual forces in the universe sometimes, but it's just like a question that I have about it. I don't have any certainty about what any of it is, or, you know, I don't have faith or whatever they call that, you know. But, you know, I know there probably is such a thing as spiritual forces in the universe. I wonder. And Buddy Holly brings this up, and other people whose work endures, you know. I just wonder how that connects. Like, what happens to human consciousness after we die? Does that die too? I wonder, you know. I'll never know until I know, but if I ever do know. But anyhow, no, I'm not religious, but my friend Steve Lillywood made this joke one time. He says, one thing nobody ever says is, oh, I'm really religious, but I'm not very spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
People always say the opposite of that. So that was a joke that he made.
So you mentioned Buddy Holly and his longevity. I mean, he was a kid when he died. And so was Hank Williams, mm-hmm. basically. Look at the output that Hank Williams did in his life. And I think he was something like 29 when he died, something like that. Very, very young. So within each person, there is sort of a potential for a gift, I think. Maybe, maybe not. But I agree with you about spirituality. Do you think there are ethical rules in life? I mean, there are things that, you know, should be done or shouldn't be done. Behavior. Do you think there are such rules?
Yeah, I do. We could all be beating each other over the head with clubs, you know, like human beings used to do, but I don't think that, I don't want to be engaged in that myself. You know, there's this thing called civilization, right? I mean, sometimes it seems like it's pretty thin, but it's there, and I'm happy about it, that there are rules and there's, you know, ethics. Yeah, for sure.
So are you a political person, Marshall Crenshaw?
I have to say I am. Yeah, I'm a political person for sure.
Well, how's that express itself?
How does it express itself?
So,
I don't know.
Well, so,
you know, I just like, I'm engaged in the whole thing of, you know, like citizenship and participation thereof. Plus, I read, I'm a reader, and I read, well, it's not a newspaper, it's an app, but, you know, I read like 4 or 5 different newspapers all the time. And I feel like it's a problem, a gigantic problem that we have in our society, that people really are unable, unless they work at it, to get any kind of in-depth information about what's affecting them in the world. A lot of people, they just can't find it or don't take the time to try and find it, you know, and I think that, you know, we look around us and see a bad result from that, you know.
So would you ever think of running for political office yourself, Marshall Crenshaw?
No, not really. No, it's too late in life for me. My son, when he was a little boy, we went to this event and he wound up meeting Kirsten Gillibrand when she was in Congress. And after that, he said, I want to be a congressperson when I grow up. But that was a long time ago. That's as close as anybody in our family has come to wanting to have a political office.
Okay, so I guess I shouldn't ask you this, but I'm going anyway. Is the state of political affairs as we speak today in the United States troubling to you?
Yeah, of course. It really is. Well, this brings up another thing about the Guthrie Center show. Right around the time of the election, I got Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, which I'd been meaning to read anyway. And I read it, and I just thought, this is about exactly like real life almost, you know, like what's going on right now.
You bet.
And then just a little while ago, I stumbled onto that great Woody Guthrie song that you've probably known since it was written, Woody's song about Charles Lindbergh.
Mr. Charlie Lindbergh, he flew to old Berlin. Got him a big iron cross and he flew right back again to Washington, Washington. Mrs. Charlie Lindbergh, she come dressed in red. said I'd like to sleep in that pretty White House bed in Washington, Washington. Lindy said to Annie, we'll get there by and by, but we'll have to split the bed up with Wheeler, Clark, and I in Washington, Washington. Hitler wrote to Lindy, said, do your very worst. Lindy started an outfit that he called America First in Washington, Washington.
Do you know that one?
I do. I'm old, but not that old.
Okay, I don't know when he wrote the song. I don't know when he wrote the song in the 30s.
Well, yes. Well, he was certainly prolific, and Arlo has certainly inherited a lot of that prolificness. You know, it was so great.
Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning your wife. What's her first name?
Ione, I-O-N-E.
Ione, liking Alice's Restaurant, the movie. Of course, it was great.
Yeah.
And we've interviewed mm-hmm. most of the people on this program who were in it, and I'm producing it and directing it. But there was this kid, Arlo, a kid. And now you see this guy, you know, the gray hair and long gray hair and still got a phenomenal voice and can fill up auditoriums all over the world and do all of that. But what a transition we've been treated to from day one till day now.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
I suppose that was a question somehow. So it's great that you know you have that affiliation. And I just wanted to point out to everybody, we've been talking with American musician, singer, songwriter, and producer Marshall Crenshaw about the tribute concert to songwriter Doc Pomus this Saturday, August 18th. Doors open at 6. Concert at 8 p.m. You should all go because I got to tell you, you will not regret it. What a fantastic ability Doc Pomus had. And it's at the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And you can find out more at GuthrieCenter.org. Go ahead. You were going to say something?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that I hope that we can have people leave with some kind of sense of who Doc was, you know, because he was a great person. He was a great human being. He's just like so warm and, you know, really appreciative of other people's company and, you know, had a lot to give as a friend. He knew how to be your friend and obviously brilliant, gave the world some truly beloved songs everybody knows and loves. He's just like, you know, really somebody.
Okay, so I want to ask you a fast question, if I can, Marshall Crenshaw, because we're out of time. But I wanted to ask you,
okay.
You said he can be a good friend to people. Was there one incident in your life in which he was a good friend to you that made a difference?
And it was just kind of general, you know, he was just really attentive, you know, like he would just take time to get to know people that he engaged with. So when you talked to him, it was just like you felt like you were talking to somebody that cared about you, you know. He was a really good role model as a person, you know.
Well, Marshall Crenshaw, I can't tell you how I personally appreciate your giving us all this time. I was fascinated by a great deal of what you had to say today. You really have fulfilled all my expectations for this, and thank you so much for doing this. Again, Marshall Crenshaw, tribute concert to Doc Pomus, this Saturday, August 18th. Doors open at 6, concert at 8 p.m. at the Guthrie Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. You can find out more at GuthrieCenter.org. Again, Marshall Crenshaw, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Alan. It was really great to talk to you.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know.
Oh, I know
that the music's
yes,
fine like sparkling
oh,
wine. Go and have your
yes,
fun.
Oh, I know.
Laugh and sing.
Yes, I know.
But while we're
oh,
apart, don't give your
yes,
heart to anyone.
Oh,
but yes, don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch? I will never, never let you go. I love you oh so much. You can dance,
you can dance.
Go and carry
you
on till the night is gone
dance.
And it's time to
you
go.
Can dance.
If he asks, if you're all alone, can he take you home? You must tell him no. 'Cause don't forget who's taking you home, and he knows all you're gonna be.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.